Freedom Class on June 25th, Saturday at 1 p.m. Freedom Class information is on the WBAI website, wbai.org. Registration for online participation via Zoom is limited, but you can listen to our Freedom Class broadcast Saturday, June 25th at 1 p.m. Come ready to be empowered, inspired, and informed by WBAI's Freedom Class. 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 11 o'clock. Coming up next, Joy of Resistance with Fran Luck.
Joy of Resistance, we're sisters of the Joy of Resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy of Resistance, we have found the joy in resistance. For those who gain by keeping women down, we say your numbers up, don't underestimate our persistence. Keeping organized together, we have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance, sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And good morning. This is the Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. I am Fran Luck. And today is a day that the decision that unfortunately we are all on tenterhooks about, the decision about whether Roe versus Wade will be overturned by the Supreme Court, did not come down. However, that might happen tomorrow. We're sitting here kind of in the shadow of this momentous decision that knocks out, well, it doesn't really knock out, but let's just say it puts a rather large obstacle in the way of fulfilling the dream of full reproductive rights for all people in this country that was made into law, that became law in 1973 with the Roe versus Wade decision, which a packed court, packed conservatively, packed ultra conservatively, is probably about to overturn. And that's been the big news for a while. So here we are, hard to believe we have arrived at this moment. And while the court may be defining this moment for the moment, we mustn't forget that it is we who defined having reproductive rights legal in this country in the first place. And we will continue to define this issue as we resist and as we fight back over the next coming period. Now, this show, Joy of Resistance, is just about 20 years old. We had our first show in April of 2002, our first show on the great WBAI. And we were honored then to be able to produce radio for WBAI, and we are still honored today. Now, tellingly, our very first show in 2002 was on the subject of abortion rights. One of our co-founders, Billy Avery, was a very well-known pioneer in Black women's health. And she helped to name the show, The Joy of Resistance. And we spoke with her, Manajay Sabah, and a whole lot of other guests about the state of reproductive rights in this country, because it has been under attack for so many years, almost from the inception of when the abortion became legal in this country. And here we are again. Here we are again, 20 years later, hard to believe. We have been bringing you feminism, the fight of women around the world for full equal rights, full human rights, and liberation that is going on in every country and culture on the planet in one form or another. And that is our topic of Joy of Resistance. We want to first of all ask you if you value the fact that we have been on the case for 20 years for women's rights, which is, I must say, often put on the bottom of the list in many leftist circles. It's kind of given a little tokenistic place. We put it front and center on this show. If you value that, we want to ask you, before we do anything else, to show your appreciation by calling our pledge number at 212-209-2950, or going to give to WBAI, that's the number 2, making a donation in any amount, or even better, becoming a WBAI sustaining member, because we are fighting, as we often are, for our lives to stay on the air, because we are behind in the tower rent, and in the rent, it is very, very hard to sustain a radio network simply on listener donations. We have no commercial donations whatsoever. And that's because we don't have sponsors. We don't even have foundation donations. We rely on you. So if you appreciate the programming that we bring you, please call and show that today. It would be so important. So I want to get into today's show. We are going to be having an amazing conversation, first of all, with Professor Peggy Cooper Davis of NYU. She's the professor of lawyering and ethics there, and she has been writing in many venues, including The Economist, on the fact that the entire legal theory behind Roe versus Wade leaves out the contribution of Reconstruction, the Reconstruction amendments, the amendments to the Constitution that took place after the Civil War, ostensibly with the goal of freeing Black people, which she reasons included reproductive rights. And she thinks that should be the basis, particularly the 14th Amendment. We've been having a discussion with her in a very few minutes, a live discussion. So we're really looking forward to that. And in the second part of the show, we're going to be speaking with Carrie N. Baker, who's a professor of American Studies and part of the Women and Gender Studies program at Smith College. And for our purposes, even more importantly, she's a hell of a journalist who's been writing up a storm on all kinds of issues related to this moment in the reproductive rights history of the United States. We'll be focusing on medication abortion, which is going to become much bigger as more clinics close if abortion becomes criminalized. And speaking of criminalization of abortion, we'll be talking about the internet surveillance of women that will be happening as women are tracked to see if they have had an abortion. And there are so many ways we can be tracked through our cell phones, et cetera. And there's a lot of talk about that. We'll be going through that. We will be looking at whether Joe Biden really can help the situation that we may soon find ourselves in through executive order. And is he willing? We'll even be talking about voting. So stay tuned for that very far-ranging interview that will be in the second half of the show. So what we're going to do at this point is we are going to go to some music, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Colors of My Womb. And when we come out of that, we hope to have Professor Cooper Davis on the line with us. And you will hear some very, very interesting connections that Professor Davis will make about the roots, the foundation of our whole theory about reproductive rights in this country. So why don't you just stay tuned? And we will be back right after our musical break.
When I went out for a walk, a hand around my mouth, an intruder to the colors of my womb. I was young and did not understand the facts of life. Broken home, love was rare and life a fight. Then I came across a young boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my womb. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had arranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb. Now the president and all his men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decision.
And I believe that we have Professor Peggy Davis Cooper, Peggy Cooper Davis online. Are you there, Professor Davis?
I am here. Good morning.
Oh, thank you for so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you, and I'm very glad our call went through. Good morning. Let me introduce you. Professor Peggy Cooper Davis is a professor, a law professor at NYU. She is the Shad Professor of Lawyering and Ethics. She joined the NYU Law Faculty in 1983 after having served as a judge for 3 years in the New York State Family Court. She has published 2 books, more than 50 articles. One of her specialties is cross-racial interactions in the legal system. And she has been writing lately, particularly an article in The Economist that brought me to get in touch with her, called Overturning Abortion Rights Ignores Freedoms Awarded After Slavery's End. So once again, good morning and welcome, Professor Cooper Davis.
Thank you.
And you're very welcome. And so let's get right into it. You argue in this wonderful article in The Economist, which I urge everybody to read, that constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War to guarantee freedom to formerly enslaved people also enshrined reproductive rights. Well, this is a very unique theory, and I believe a very important one. So let's follow your article. You begin by talking about the U.S. Constitution's vagueness in regard to personal rights. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let me ask you, to what do you attribute that vagueness and those holes that then needed very much to be filled?
Well, I want to start by observing that most constitutions in democracies around the world now have very clear statements of rights. And most of them include provisions that are easily interpreted as covering family autonomy and personal autonomy. Our Constitution doesn't have that. Initially, it had no Bill of Rights. There was complaint about that, and a Bill of Rights was added subsequently, quickly. But it only applied to the federal government. It was a Bill of Rights that only restrained the federal government. It didn't restrain the states or individuals. Now, one might ask, why wasn't there a general Bill of Rights as there is in most democracies? My thesis is that one of the important reasons for that was that you couldn't have a general statement of human rights and at the same time have slavery. Mm-hmm. If people had a right to personal autonomy, to family autonomy, a right to form families at all, or other basic rights, then people couldn't be enslaved.
Right.
So I am arguing that, and I'm not certainly the only one, many historians have said that the absence of clear statements of rights in our Constitution had to do with the preservation of slavery. It had to do with the compromise between the non-slaveholding states and the slaveholding states over that issue.
Right. And I want to say that when I read your article, a light bulb went off in my head because, you know, I had never made that exact connection. And it's a stunningly important connection in terms of how our whole jurisprudence apparatus in the United States developed. So thank you just for that. But yes, but then you go on and you talk about the Bill of Rights, as you say, it only dealt with infringements by the federal government, not by individuals or, you know, or individual states. And since we are looking in this development for legalities that will affect our reproductive rights, you talk a lot about where reproductive rights, and that is, of course, you know, ironic because there were none, for enslaved people were at, because you feel that there's a connection to the laws that freed enslaved people in the United States, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And maybe you can draw that together. What are those connections between this situation of enslaved people under slavery and the later amendments, and why you feel that reproductive rights are actually situated in those amendments, the basis for reproductive rights?
Sure. It's a little complicated, but I think straightforward once you piece it together. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War can be understood, and I think should be understood, as anti-slavery amendments. I've said already that they undid, or they cured the flaw in the Constitution in that there was no human rights constraint upon states or individuals. But when I went to look at the debates of those amendments, and also the debates of civil rights legislation that was being passed right after the Civil War, I saw repeatedly that members of Congress were talking about what the effect of these amendments would be, what the post-Reconstruction world would look like. And time again, they said, it will be, in effect, the opposite of slavery. Mm-hmm. One congressperson said, slavery cannot have a home. With this legislation, everyone can have a home. One could not have a recognized and secure attachment to a spouse. When these amendments are passed, that will end. One could not have control of one's children. When these amendments are passed, that will end. And another thing that was mentioned that comes closest to the argument about abortion rights is that there were many references to the practice of breeding slaves, mm-hmm. That enslaved people forced into sexual encounters in order to increase the stock of a slave owner. And so this, too, was going to end, this control over people's reproductive lives and this control over one's progeny in addition to oneself. Mm-hmm. And so what we can understand from that is that there was an effort to describe freedom. And freedom was described repeatedly in contrast to slavery. And the absence of family rights had to be ended.
Yes. I really hear where you are going. It is such a well-reasoned argument and a very moving argument. In your article in The Economist, you talk about the resistances that took place under the slave system to the complete control of their reproductive capacity by the state holders, that is, the resistances by the enslaved people while they were enslaved. And can you talk about some of those resistances to that reproductive tyranny that happened during the period of enslavement?
Yes. As I was initially doing my research on this matter, I found just all kinds of shocking stories. And these were things that had been uncovered by historians in the past, but these connections hadn't been made. But doctors who were interviewed who had treated enslaved people when they got medical treatment frequently reported that they had discovered that women had used a number of devices to try to prevent conception. Sometimes they were herbs, sometimes they were physical devices. But it was clear that people were trying not to produce children who would be immediately enslaved and whom they could not claim as family members. And, of course, the shattering and shocking incidents are incidents in which women killed their children and killed themselves in order to escape themselves from slavery and in order to prevent their children being, their infants being enslaved. Now, I have to rush to say that I'm not arguing that there's a right to infanticide. Certainly there comes a point where intervention is appropriate. But I think that when you imagine an enslaved woman who has perhaps been forced to have sex with someone for breeding purposes rather than because she had an affectionate relationship with that person, does not want to be pregnant, does whatever she can to avoid becoming pregnant, and does that, of course, as an enslaved woman, at great risk of punishment. And you can imagine, I mean, Toni Morrison helped us imagine in The Beloved the desperation of someone who would turn to suicide and to the murder of their children to keep them out of slavery.
Right. So thank you for that. The right to not procreate under conditions of slavery was being manifested, or shall we say, fought for or resisted toward during slavery. And you therefore take it to the different amendments under Reconstruction, which were meant to ameliorate all of that. And you talk particularly about the 14th Amendment, and I'd like to go to some of the language of the 14th Amendment that you invoke, because you are saying, I believe, that that language would really be a better basis for the reproductive right, for reproductive rights legally in the United States, than the one that we currently use, which is kind of a little, it's called the shadow or penumbra implications of a number of parts of the Bill of Rights, etc., and some of the 14th Amendment. But talk about the 14th Amendment and why it undergirds reproductive rights.
Well, the 14th Amendment, of course, did some very important things that are consistent with the effort to assure that conditions like slavery could no longer exist in the United States. And one of them was to overrule a Supreme Court case pre-Civil War that had held that African Americans were not citizens. So one of the first things that you find in the 14th Amendment is a definition of citizenship, which did not exist in the original Constitution. The original Constitution did not say who was a citizen of the United States. So this is where you find the language that if you were born or naturalized in the United States, you were a citizen of the United States. So the first thing I argue is that by being a citizen, you incur a bundle of rights that is to be defined. The second thing the 14th Amendment says is that you cannot be denied the privileges and immunities of a citizenship. And again, what the privileges and immunities of citizenship are is to be defined, but all of these family rights that I have talked about were privileges and immunities of citizenship. The drafters of the Reconstruction Amendments went further, and they said that no person will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, it is that clause, known as the Due Process Clause, that I argue is the sounder basis for reproductive rights, because one is being denied liberty, and one is being denied liberty without appropriate justification. And the due process of law language has been interpreted so that it means, not only does it mean that whenever the government does something to you, they have to follow appropriate procedures, but it means that some things that the government might do to you are so extreme and so much in violation of your rights as a human being and a citizen that the strictest scrutiny has to be given to that action. And it is currently under this idea that the Due Process Clause protects liberty in a substantive way, that the right of abortion choice is, I think, most soundly protected.
Yes. Wow. What a chain of reasoning. We are just about at the end of our discussion, and what I wanted to end with is what you write at the end of your article, which is in The Economist, and I'll give the title of that in a moment. You say, it is consistent with the anti-slavery spirit of the Reconstruction Amendments that people under the jurisdiction of a reconstructed United States hold the right to choose whether and when they will reproduce. The spirit of the Reconstruction Amendments. And yes, it's a wonderful conclusion. And I don't know where we're going as a country from here on reproductive rights, but I think this kind of examination and the multiple ways in which reproductive rights are justified, if it need any justification, is so, what you contributed is so important to that understanding and the understanding of the actual history of the United States. So I want to thank you very, very much, Professor Peggy Cooper Davis, who we've been speaking with. And the name of your article is Overturning Abortion Rights Ignores Freedom Awarded After Freedoms Rather Awarded After Slavery's End. So it has been just great speaking with you, and I look forward to seeing more of your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. So that was an interview I was very much looking forward to. And once again, thank you to Professor Peggy Cooper Davis coming to Joy of Resistance on relatively short notice to have that amazing discussion. We are going to, we're going to finish up with more of Colors of My Womb by Sweet Honey in the Rock. And then we're going to go to a wonderful interview with our next guest, who is Carrie Ann Baker. And we're going to be, it's a very far-ranging discussion on so many of the events happening around this intense period of a possible overturn of Roe versus Wade. It's a discussion you're going to want to hear, and we're going to ask you to get a pencil and paper or whatever you record with and take some notes, because it's a lot of information. So please stay tuned.
Now the president and all his men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decisions that they set me up for anyway. Insult my mind, my rights, the issues of my womb. My womb.
All right. And that's Sweet Honey in the Rock, Colors of My Womb. And we are going to go to our interview with Carrie Ann Baker in just a second. I just want to tell you that it's a very far ranging. Once again, please take out your pencils and papers. You are listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on the web at WBAI.org, coming out of New York City. And we have been here for about 61 years, bringing you non-commercial alternative radio, dependent completely on your donations. Your donations. If you value this kind of programming, if perhaps you just learned something from that interview, and if you learn things every day from the amazing array of programs on this station, you really might want to consider contributing, because right now we are trying to keep our transmitter on the air. Yes, our transmitter. You couldn't hear my voice if we didn't have a transmitter at 4 Times Square that goes out to 3 states. Costs a lot of money to keep that going. We implore you, we urge you, for the sake of the station, for your own sake, to please give us a ring at 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org. That's the number 2. Make a contribution in any amount, or even better, say you want to be a sustaining member, a buddy. Say you want to be a buddy in the name of Joy of Resistance, now here for 20 years, bringing you feminism and a kind of feminism you're not going to hear anywhere else. Please do that as we put on our wonderful interview that we were about to play with Carrie N. Baker, which is a very broad discussion, including the problems of surveillance of women that are going to be arising with the probable overturn of Roe versus Wade. That's right. People, the government, whomever, will be able to tell if you've gone to an abortion clinic or not through your cell phone. And it's not unlikely that there will be a lot of that kind of surveillance, particularly in states where abortion is illegal, which may be all of our states if we don't fight back big time. Enough. Let's go to that interview. I am speaking with Carrie N. Baker, who is the Bauman Professor of American Studies in the Women and Gender Study Department at Smith College. And she is a journalist and has been writing about many different aspects of the struggle over abortion, the crisis, actually, that we are in right now. Good morning, Carrie. Welcome to Joy of Resistance.
Good morning. Great to be here.
We are sitting here waiting daily for this horrid decision to come down, and we pretty much know where we will be at when it does. But in the meantime, there are frantic efforts going on both sides and a lot of stuff to be gone over about what we face, what we can do, possibilities of resistance, both long and short term. So we're going to get into a lot of that. Let's start with what these 25 senators have been trying to do, what they think Biden should do at this critical moment, and what he can do.
Absolutely. So yeah, a few days ago, U.S. Senators Patty Murray, who's a Democrat from Washington, and Elizabeth Warren, who's a Democrat from Massachusetts, joined with 23 other senators to urge President Biden to issue an executive order and have a full of government response to this crisis that we're in, which is that the Supreme Court is about to overturn Roe versus Wade. And they're urging the president to try to figure out what can he do with the presidential powers that he has with the executive branch of the government. And so they've suggested a number of different things that he might do. And one of them I think is particularly interesting is that obviously the federal government owns land in every state, including these red states that are banning abortion. And so they've asked him to develop ways to use federal property and resources to increase access to abortion. So he's talked about analyzing the types of reproductive health services that could be provided on federal property, especially in states that are these red states that will ban abortion, or moving military personnel and families to places where they can access these services, or making sure federal employees have time off and reimbursement for travel to go get the abortion health care they need. They're encouraging him to try to increase access to medication abortion. So various federal agencies could take action, like the FDA could issue a ruling saying that the FDA has approved abortion pills and no state can ban them because, you know, federal preemption, federal law preempts state law. So things like that, they're encouraging him to think creatively, you know, Health and Human Services, different departments within the government. Right. What can they do to support abortion access?
Has he shown signs of being serious and having plans for any of the alternatives you just mentioned?
No, he hasn't. I mean, he has historically been a moderate on abortion. And, you know, he's moved a little bit more toward abortion rights in this most recent election. An example is historically he was in favor of the Hyde Amendment, which bans Medicaid funding for abortion. He has switched his position on that. And he could, by the way, do more to change that policy, which is still in place. But he hasn't responded specifically to this letter yet. The letter was sent to him on June 7th. So he has had a couple weeks, but we haven't heard anything from him that I'm aware of.
Okay. We need to be clear on that. And we also need to be clear that even if he did all of those things that you just mentioned, they would only affect a small portion of the women who might be needing abortions. So let's talk about what separates us at this moment in history from what women faced before Roe versus Wade became legal, and that is we now have medication abortion that is widely available on the internet, and we didn't have the internet back then. So that has changed the scenario, and of course medication abortion is under attack, and medication abortion, when you describe what it is, Carrie, and the actions that are being taken to protect access to it at this point.
So abortion pills are actually two different kinds of pills. The first pill is called mifepristone, and it blocks progesterone. Progesterone is the hormone that keeps a pregnancy going. So if you block progesterone, the pregnancy begins to shed from the uterus. 24 hours after you take mifepristone, you take misoprostol, which is actually a widely available ulcer medication, but it causes contractions of the uterus. So you take that, and it expels the contents of the uterus. By the way, you can also just take misoprostol alone to cause abortion. So those two pills are really a game changer as far as post-Roe versus pre-Roe. I always say, you know, we're not going to see emergency rooms full of septic and dying women. I mean, there definitely will be some women that end up in the hospital because of illegal abortions. But if we can get abortion pill information out there and make these pills widely available, it will be much safer. And the way that I know that is because abortion pills are being used around the world in countries that make abortion illegal. And the death rate from illegal abortion has dropped because of access to abortion pills. These pills are safer than Tylenol. They're super safe and they're really easy to take. The main limitation is that you should take them early in pregnancy. So the World Health Organization says that you can take them through 13 weeks of pregnancy. But if you can get them and take them, they're a very safe way to have an early abortion.
Can you talk about some of the organizing that's being done to protect access to abortion medication over the internet?
Right now, only two states prohibit self-managed abortion, South Carolina and Oklahoma. But I think that we are going to see red states not only ban abortion, but criminalize the people who have abortions, people that order pills and use them. And that's already happened, even in the absence of explicit laws. But I think that effort to go after people who access abortion pills will increase post-Roe. And, you know, that is going to be something we're going to have to contend with. I know that there are blue states trying to think of ways in which they can get abortion pills to people in a safe way. For instance, here in Massachusetts, where I live, there is legislation currently being considered that would protect abortion providers in the state who provide abortion to people in red states. So for instance, if a doctor here in Massachusetts has a patient in Texas, the practice would be defined as occurring where the doctor is rather than the patient. And that way people would get, you know, physician supervised medical care, and then the doctor would mail the pills to the person in Texas. Now, again, that still could potentially be a problem for the person in Texas. And so it will be hard. But you know, the other thing that people can do is just order pills online. There's an organization called PlanCPills.org, which has a website with a drop-down menu by state. And you can put your state in the menu and find exactly how you can get abortion pills and whether it's legal or not, where you can order them from, what the status is, how much they cost, how long it takes to get to you. There's also an organization called the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, and it's available to assist people medically with using abortion pills. So there's doctors and nurses who are available most hours of the day. You can contact them by phone or by text and ask any medical questions you have about how to use the pills or your symptoms. And that's a wonderful resource. And then the third resource I'd like to mention is there's an organization called If One How that has a repro legal hotline. So if you're concerned about the legal status of ordering pills from the state that you're located in, you can contact them and ask them any legal questions that you have. So the movement is trying to sort of create this support structure for people that are in red states and need abortion pills. How can you find good quality pills? How do you use them? And then how can you protect yourself legally?
Mm-hmm. And also 70 reproductive health rights and justice organizations have created a campaign called Abortion on Our Own Terms, abortiononourownterms.org.
Yes, you can go on their website and it lists all these organizations that I'm mentioning. And if you're an activist and you want to share this information with others, they've made videos and GIFs and other kinds of, you know, posters and visuals that you can share on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. They really want to try to get the word out there about how to get abortion pills and self-manage an abortion using pills so that people have the access that they need post-Roe.
Critical work to be doing right now, along with the work of active resistance in the streets, which is going on even as we speak, which is on Wednesday. We know that by tomorrow, the decision may come down on the Dobbs case, which would basically overturn Roe, we believe, according to the leaked Alito draft. And many people are gathering at the Supreme Court. And if you can possibly get to Washington, D.C., you're being urged to go there. It's important there be a gigantic showing because we're not going to win our rights back unless there are consequences happening, unless there is no business as usual, unless,
absolutely,
right, there is a price to pay by those who have decided that we don't need these rights, which, of course, we won. We won them fair and square, and they are our rights, our human rights. So
they're inherent rights. I mean, it doesn't matter that they recognize them or not. We have these rights. They're our rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tyranny is not just, and abortion bans are tyranny. You can't force somebody to do this, and it's immoral in my mind.
Absolutely. But they are going to try, it is looking like, and that brings us to the subject of surveillance. And we are also in a different situation now than we were in pre-Roe because of the internet and its incredibly magnified capacity to surveil us all, including those who seek abortions. Can you speak to that, please?
Absolutely. So you're based in New York. I know there's an organization called Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, STOP, and they just put out a report called Pregnancy Panopticon, Abortion Surveillance After Roe. And it is a chilling report about all the tools that law enforcement and anti-abortion groups can and are using to track our periods, our pregnancies, and our efforts to gain access to abortion. And you can read the report, but they talk about the ways in which they're using cutting-edge digital technologies to surveil women's search history, their location data, their messages, their online purchases, their social media activities. And that's by using things like geofencing or keyword warrants or big data, machine learning, other things. And I think that we all need to get up to speed on how to protect ourselves when we're online. If you're not using a virtual private network, a VPN, Tor or Nord, you need to be. You need to use it on your phone as well as on your computer. And by the way, whether or not you're looking for abortion information, our privacy is very weak here in the United States. We have very weak laws. Just yesterday, Mazie Hirono introduced legislation called My Body, My Data, which is to protect reproductive health data. Because we see what's coming. The post-Roe anti-abortion states are going to be surveilling us through our online presences and through our physical presences, through things like geofencing.
Carrie, can you tell us what geofencing is? Because our listeners may not be familiar with the term.
Yeah, it's where they can track you by tracking your phone and they can see where you've been. And that is data that exists that can be subpoenaed or obtained, purchased, quite frankly, and then used to try to figure out who is accessing abortion data. And that could be you physically go to a clinic and they can track that, or it could be that, you know, they're looking at what you're doing on your phone. And so I think that we all need to get smarter about how we use our phones and technology. And there are wonderful organizations like the Digital Defense Fund and the Electronic Frontier Foundation that have information about what you can do specifically when you're looking for abortion information online, to protect yourself.
All right. That's really, really good to know. And where can people find the article that you just wrote, which goes into a lot more detail on this whole issue of surveillance?
So that article is on Ms. Magazine. It's called Enforcing Criminal Abortion Bans Post-Roe, A Massive Escalation of Surveillance.
Yes, very frightening stuff. I know Poland has just established a pregnancy register after they've banned almost all abortions. So this was the stuff of science fiction, of The Handmaid's Tale. A friend of mine did a cartoon many years ago in which she has a person sending in a used tampon to a federal agency to prove whether she is menstruating or not. And it was just, you know, considered a kind of sci-fi futuristic dystopian cartoon.
Well, Fran, and, you know, they used to do that to Mike Pence in Indiana when he was passing all those restrictions on abortion in the early 2010s. Periods for Pence. And they would send their pads and tampons to Pence. So it's been done here too.
I remember. But that was, you know, that was a spoof. This is a dystopian world where that's the law, that you have to send in your tampons to register whether you are or not pregnant.
Yeah.
And that is very, very, very scary. Heaven knows women have been surveilled informally about pregnancy, abortion, et cetera, and sexual activity for centuries. Yeah. And now it is moving apparently to a new level with the internet. So we've got a lot here to consider, and we've got a lot to be very, very angry about, and we've got a lot to organize against, including voting, right? Because, you know, as Malcolm X said, by any means necessary, so that even includes voting. But voting is only one part of it. We've all got to get a lot more active. And I think you would agree with that.
Absolutely, Fran. I want to say, you know, these elections coming up are going to be really important because we need to get 52 Democrats in the Senate so we can override the filibuster and pass the Women's Health Protection Act, which would legalize abortion throughout the United States. With Manchin and Sinema, they will not override the filibuster. So we need two more Democrats. And there are six states that we have a good chance of winning. And I can tell you those states, I would love to encourage your listeners to help out in those states. They're Nevada, New Hampshire, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona. We have good shots for Democratic senators in those states, and folks need to get out and do that because, you know, otherwise, if the Republicans win in 24, they are going to ban abortion throughout the United States. So we need to try to protect these rights.
Right. All right. By any means necessary, we must protect our rights. Thank you so much, Carrie Ann Baker, for being a guest on Joy of Resistance.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Okay, that was the Joy of Resistance interview with Carrie Ann Baker. Look for her work in Ms. Magazine. And talking about some very serious issues that are going to arise if Roe is overturned, which we unfortunately expect to happen within days. That includes in states where 26 states are ready. They have the so-called trigger laws all ready. They just, with a push of a button, abortion will become illegal in those states if Roe is overturned. And everything is going to change. A lot is going to change. Not that it hasn't been good in terms of access because, in terms of access because the right wing has been making inroads and shutting down abortion clinics all over the country so that there are very, very few places in which you can obtain an abortion in many, many states, if any. So now it's going even further, and we think they want to go even farther, and they want to eliminate the laws in states like New York, which do protect abortion rights within this state. And we think they're going to seek a federal amendment to make abortion completely illegal in all over the country. And then the U.S. will join the countries that we've been covering on Joy of Resistance for years as prosecuting women for having abortions or even miscarriages, which could be construed as having abortions, countries like El Salvador and much of South America. Today, South America is moving in a different direction. We have Chile, we have Mexico, we have Colombia, India, we have a number of other countries moving toward legalizing abortion as the United States moves backwards and becomes one of the most backward countries on this issue. This is in spite of the fact that 61% to 28% of U.S.ans do not want Roe overturned, and yet the Supreme Court, against the popular will, is imposing this on us. So, you know, what's that chant? Abortion rights under attack. What do? Act up, rise up, fight back. Or end Roe? Hell no. Right now, there are many, many people at the Supreme Court awaiting the decision. I expect there will be massive civil disobedience as the decision comes down. This is a critical moment in U.S. history, a right that we have had that we won 50 years ago is now being taken away. Can they do that without consequences? Well, that's up to us, isn't it? So Joy of Resistance will be continuing to be on the case as this progresses. We ask for your support as a show and as a radio station, WBAI. If you think that you want this kind of programming to keep you up to date on what is happening as situations change, please call our pledge line at 212-209-2950 or go to givetowbai.org. Make a donation in the name of Joy of Resistance. We would really appreciate it. We've been doing this for 20 years. We intend to continue to do it. You will be kept apprised of what is happening. We are going to sign off at this point. We're going out with Bikini Kill's Meet You in the Streets because that's where great movements arise and begin. And we are going to have to go back to, in some ways, to the beginning on this. We've been fighting for 50 years. We will continue this struggle. And Joy of Resistance will be there on the case. So, good day. You can reach us at JOR at WBAI.org, JOR at WBAI.org, or follow us on Twitter at Joy of Resistance. Have a good day in spite of everything.
People answer the call to public service in such different ways.
Mississippi Representative Benny Thompson, chair of the January 6th committee investigating the attack on the Capitol.
Some run for office. Some volunteer to make sure their neighbors can get to their voting locations. Some work at polling sites to help Election Day go smoothly. Some look into problems to guarantee our elections are secure and accurate.
Thompson says people who have testified at the hearings represent the backbone of our democracy in its most important moments, when citizens cast their votes and when votes are counted.
But for Donald Trump, these witnesses and others like them were another roadblock to his attempt to cling to power. On Thursday, we'll hear about another part of that scheme. His attempt to corrupt the country's top law enforcement body, the Justice Department, to support his attempt to overturn the election.
Please join us Thursday from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. for Pacifica Radio's coverage of the hearings right here, streaming at WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM on listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI New York.
And that's what you're tuned to, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. And just let me remind you again, we're trying to raise funds for our tower, our transmitter, so we can continue to broadcast to, in some cases, four states in all directions, parts of Connecticut, parts of New Jersey, parts of upstate New York, and parts of New Jersey. It is 12 noon in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. And coming up next, we have an encore presentation of Gary Null.